We are talking again with Jav Parrish, co-editor of Eat the State, and we're talking to him this week by phone. Jav, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from the coast of southern Maine, where I drove in a sheer panic after realizing that I couldn't take Seattle anymore, but I'll be back in a couple weeks.
All right, really? No, why are you there?
I'm there because my wife refuses to fly, and this is where her family lives. So every few years we do this insane road trip, and you know you run out of ways to drive across Kansas or North Dakota after a while that are new and innovative. But you know, every do this trip, it seems like it comes up with a different sort of theme. And the one this year, and I wrote about this on the WorkingForChange.com site today, is very much global warming, because it's amazing how many different subtle little ways and not so subtle ways it's manifesting parts of the country. You know, we spent the first night over in eastern Washington, and the friends that we know there have had all these problems with wildfires that they've never had before. The next day, going through the northern Rockies, you see these whole vast forests that have been decimated by pine beetles, which never used to be in the region, but because the winters are warmer now, they're moving north, and there's no natural predators and no natural defenses against it, so these enormous forests are disappearing all the way through the Canadian Rockies and up to south central Alaska. And you know, for Midwest, they've been hit really hard by drought, and all these fields are brown for the last couple of years in a row. Driving through Massachusetts a couple of days ago, I actually saw kudzu, which used to be just a southeastern U.S. There's no way 20 years before it in New England winter. And they've had massive flooding problems here all spring and summer from torrential downpours. We had another one this afternoon. And, you know, all of these things are reported just as there was this massive heat wave a couple of weeks ago on the East Coast, that you know, newsrooms spent enormous amounts of money reporting that it was hot outside, really hot. You know, you got these front page photos of, you know, children in parks and, you know, tons of water in them. And yet when Britain had its second ever 100 degree day a few weeks ago, the first one ever recorded was in 2004, they had no problems putting global warming into the headline. But none of these elements get tied to global warming in news coverage here, but it's, you know, it's all related, and you know, we're seeing it happen before our eyes, and you know, you wonder how long our government can keep its head up its butt. People who pay it, neither Democrat nor Republican nor even particularly care about politics, understand that the environment is changing and what the consequences are if we don't do anything. It's a real eye opener to drive across the country and see it.
Well, maybe this week we can start out with international news, since that has been getting headlines. But of course, the coverage is always kind of questionable.
Yeah, a lot, of course, has been going on the last couple of weeks since we did the last program, with Lebanon and Israel's bombing and scattered ground forces invading Lebanon as well. This week, of course, we had the somewhat fruitless diplomatic trip of Condoleezza Rice, which is, you know, really, you remember back in the days of Henry Kissinger and secretaries of state before and after him, who used to do these shuttle diplomacy kind of things from state to state? Condoleezza Rice cannot credibly do that in the Middle East for a couple of reasons. Number one, the U.S. is actively helping one side in this conflict. It's using satellite imagery and giving information to the Israeli military to be able to use in its targeting for its bombing. And the cooperation is probably going on, you know, beyond that. Certainly most of the weaponry that Israel is using in this conflict was made in the United States, and quite a bit of it was either given by the U.S. government or sold at, on easy credit terms. It really is unquestioned in the international community whose side the U.S. is on. The other thing is that the United States, and to a lesser degree Britain, have been the only international players trying to intervene in this conflict that have been resisting calls for a ceasefire. Israel wants nothing to do with a ceasefire. They want to crush Hezbollah so much as they can. Hezbollah has been calling for a ceasefire since this began, and said that it would, you know, exchange the two Israeli soldiers within 6 hours of a ceasefire. Now, you know, you may or may not take them at their word, but that's what they've been saying. That's also what the Lebanese parliament has been saying. And, you know, the European Union and various other international agencies and the UN have also been trying to get Israel interested in a ceasefire to no avail. And Rice has not played a constructive role in that at all. In fact, you know, you see these headlines mostly in the British press of, for example, a week and a half ago, the U.S. will give Israel another week to launch its attack. Well, that week is come and gone, and now it's maybe a couple more weeks, and, you know, there'll be another week after that, and so on, so long as Israel thinks it's accomplishing what it wants to accomplish. The other thing that happened this week, of course, was the Israeli government, you know, quite intentionally, almost undoubtedly quite intentionally, bombed a UN observation post in Lebanon, killing a number of international peacekeepers, including a number of Canadians. United Nations Kofi Annan called the attack deliberate, at which, you know, Israeli leaders took great umbrage, but, you know, there's no other way to interpret it. They were flattened by a number of large bombs targeting the building. And within a few days, the UN has withdrawn its observers from border areas in southern Lebanon, fearing, quite rightly, I think, for their safety. And the thing to understand about the observation post that was bombed is it was gathering information being reported throughout Lebanon on civilian atrocities, both through the Israeli ground forces that have gone into the country and also the airstrikes that have happened against Lebanese civilians. Not against Hezbollah fighters, but against Lebanese civilians. That's one of the things that the UN Observation Post was doing, and that almost certainly is why Israel bombed it, and they almost certainly bombed it with targeting information that was provided by the U.S. military. So, you know, the blood is very much on our hands in this one, too. You know, there were assurances yesterday that were somewhat encouraging Israel, saying that it's not going to launch a full ground invasion of Lebanon, rather, at least not, you know, for the foreseeable future. They could always change their mind, of course, and that it has, quote, no intention of bombing Syria. So, you know, it doesn't seem quite as likely that it's inevitably going to escalate into an all-out regional war the way many of us were concerned about in the first few days. But it's really no thanks to the role that the United States has played in this conflict. And, of course, the Lebanese civilians, the people caught in the crossfire of this, are the ones really paying a horrific price. And, you know, for anybody who's seen the carnage on television, not so much on American network TV, but if you have satellite, you can see Al Jazeera pictures or on the internet or whatever. The devastation is truly remarkable, and there's no question that they're targeting civilian infrastructure as well as, you know, supposed outposts of Hezbollah. One other item, I think, at the same time that Israel was saying that it's not going to launch the ground invasion or invade Syria, they were, in fact, calling up reserve troops for their army, for their ground forces. So chances are pretty good at some point, I think, that they will go into Lebanon. And beyond that, it's clear that they're expecting that this is going to be, you know, a longer-term conflict, that they're not planning on stopping for a ceasefire in another week or 2 weeks. They're certainly making provisions anyway to grind this out over a much longer period. And because of the of a number of Israeli soldiers on Wednesday and the rocket attacks that Hezbollah has continued to launch into northern Israel, there is tremendous public support in Israel right now for continuing this conflict, for invading Lebanon. In fact, Olmert, the Israeli prime minister, is getting quite a bit of political heat at home because he hasn't launched a full-out invasion of Lebanon yet. So, you know, Israel has held back to some extent, although, again, the carnage of Lebanese civilians has been significant. It hasn't been nearly as bad as what Israel could choose to do, and the pressure is all in the direction of Israel trying to do it. And the U.S. is one of the few international actors that's, you know, helping to enable that.
Speaking of enabling, let's talk a bit about Iraq.
There was another announcement this week from the United States, which is about its third in the last 2 months, that it's going to really crack down on the violence in Baghdad now. George Bush solemnly intoned that he's going to build up the troops of the U.S. Stationed within Baghdad itself from 9,000 to 13,000. This means a couple of things. Number one, it virtually guarantees that the quiet standing down of troops, the drawdown that was being scheduled for this fall so that it would help make the Republicans look good in time for the November election, is not now going to happen. The United States is aware that, you know, as we talked on the last program, the situation in Baghdad has deteriorated almost completely out of control. It really is an all-out sectarian civil war in Baghdad right now. There's virtually no security anywhere in the city to speak of. Both Iraqi police and army troops, most of whom are infiltrated by the very militias, the Shiite militias that are helping to do the fighting, and the United States military have just been standing by and letting a lot of this violence happen. It's also creating a tremendous refugee crisis. But think about this. The U.S. is only sending in an additional 4,000 troops to a force that's already been completely inadequate to do anything about the fighting there. This in a city of 5 million people, at least not counting the refugees that have now poured out of the city, which you can subtract a 500,000. But by comparison, New York City has 8 million people. So let's just say, for sake of argument, it's double the population. It's actually a little bit less than that, but, you know, say double. New York City has 40,000 police officers in New York City in a city of 8 million. You know, so having an extra 4,000 or a total of 13,000 military in Baghdad isn't going to make that much difference. And New York City, the last I checked, was not in the middle of an all-out civil war. So, you know, the kind of forces that they're talking about beefing up the U.S. military presence in Baghdad is really just a PR campaign for the folks back home. It is not going to make a significant dent in the violence there. There were a number of other interesting developments in Iraq the last couple of weeks. The parliament there, remember, this is the government that the United States has been allied itself with and has essentially helped put into place, unanimously voted to condemn the Israeli offensive and asked the UN Security Council and G8 leaders to stop, quote, stop the Israeli criminal aggression. So that tells you how much on the same page the U.S. and the Shiite installed government are in Iraq. Iraq and the U.S. Have also signed, this is something that, oddly enough, did not make the headlines here, a, quote, commercial cooperation agreement for free markets and privatization of Iraqi resources. This is something that neocons have wanted, have been pushing for since day one. It's all about enabling U.S. corporations to sell their wares in Iraq without any tariffs, and for U.S. corporations to be able to control the privatized assets of what were once Iraqi nationally owned departments and resources. The problem with this, of course, is that there's no middle class left in Iraq, and certainly no upper class, because they've all fled for foreign countries, that can buy any U.S. products in Iraq right now. And the same goes for privatizing the resources in Iraq. There is no functional government in Iraq right now, so it's kind of ludicrous to talk about privatizing some of the social services. There aren't any social services because the country is in the middle of a civil war. But if the country ever does stabilize, the ink will be dry on this agreement, and U.S. corporations will be free to come in and take advantage. And this really was a major, major part of the rationale for, I shouldn't say the rationale, but it was certainly part of the prize that was made available for invading Iraq in the first place. And it was really very, very interesting that it got almost no media coverage in the U.S. at all, that this was signed. And then lastly, another very interesting development that hasn't taken place in Iraq itself, and so it hasn't gotten much attention, but Turkey, the country to the north of Iraq, and which shares a Kurdish minority with Iraq, Kurds within Turkey have been waging a guerrilla war against the central government and trying to secede in southeast Turkey and make it part of a Kurdistan for, you know, decades now. And the repression by the Turkish government has been ferocious. Well, the government of Turkey is very concerned that the more or less independent Iraq Kurds in the north part of the country are being used as a staging ground from which Turkish Kurdish guerrillas are launching terrorist attacks within the country of Turkey. And so Turkey is now threatening to launch an invasion of northern Iraq. Now, this may be, so much smoke and bluster, but it's a threat that has to be taken very, very seriously, particularly since the military, which is where this kind of talk is coming from, is traditionally by far the most powerful political force within the country of Turkey. And Turkey, of course, is a NATO partner, or they're trying to get into, I think they're trying to get into NATO. I don't think they're in yet, but they certainly get a lot of U.S. arms. They're the sole Muslim country that considers itself part of Europe, and therefore is seen as a very key ally in the war on terror. And, know, to have them turn around and launch a military invasion in Iraq, were that to happen, or even if there's a cross-border incursion, it could take an already very messy situation and make it much, much worse.
Jumping back to our side of the planet, Mexico is still undecided on its elections?
Yeah, and it's going to be undecided at least through September. There's a seven-judge tribunal there that is considering whether to ratify the already ratified results that gave the election to the conservative candidate Calderon. It was a very close election in which massive allegations of vote fraud are being made by Lopez Obrador, who is the left-of-center candidate who, for the time being anyway, has just lost out. Police estimated 1.1 million people rallying in Mexico City in support of Lopez Obrador 2 weeks ago tomorrow, that is Sunday. And Lopez Obrador is threatening civil disobedience. He's threatening to bring the country to its knees if there is not a full recount of every single vote in the Mexican election. And there's a lot of talk around Mexican political circles that the election itself will be nullified and a new election will need to be called because so few people among the Mexican population think that the results are legitimate right now. Particularly with the history, both with the PRI and with the U.S. Intervention in the election results, which mysteriously awarded it to the PRI in 1988, there's just a widespread belief that this election was illegitimate and that the U.S. had a hand in its illegitimacy. So it's a mess down there, both within the domestic politics of Mexico, but even more importantly for our concern, I think it's going to really sour Mexican-U.S. relations, especially if this election is overturned.
And jumping back to national, you had mentioned Turkey and NATO, and I understand George Bush has a pick for NATO now.
Yeah, there's a couple of interesting nominations that have happened in the last couple of weeks. One of them was that Bush nominated General Vance Craddock, who was the head of the Guantanamo prison complex. And now this immediately after the United States Supreme Court ruling that said that the U.S. had to abide by the Geneva Conventions and that prisoners in Guantanamo had to have due process and so forth. You know, immediately after that, Bush turns around and, you know, it's like I use this as the title of a column, I think about beginning of this year, and I forget who it was about, but it's happened so many times under George Bush. You know, shred the Constitution, win a promotion. Somebody does something bad under the Bush administration, whether it's Alberto Gonzalez or Condoleezza Rice or John Bolton or whoever it, or Stephen Hadley, whoever it might be, and they win a promotion to a more powerful office. So General Vance Craddock now has been nominated to become the head of NATO and the commander of U.S. forces in Europe. And what also does that say about sending him to Europe, where both the European Union and most of our allies individually in Europe have called for the United States to shut down Guantanamo because they see it as a stain not just on the U.S., but on all Western democracies. This is Bush's idea of playing neener, 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 you know, when you're a six-year-old. It's just ridiculous. Another nomination that Bush has made is William Haynes II. You know, you can tell what kind of class he comes from when he calls himself William Haynes II rather than William Haynes Jr. He has been the Pentagon General Counsel, been heavily involved in the Pentagon rationale that was used to justify the policies of torture under the Bush administration. He has been nominated to become a Fourth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals judge, which is a lifetime appointment. Very powerful judgeship, one step below the Supreme Court. That nomination is in trouble in the Senate. Even a number of Senate Republicans are having trouble swallowing that one.
All right. What's been going on with Abramoff?
Well, quite a bit, actually. Mostly elections. There were a couple of primaries that were held in the South that were really interesting. One of them is that Ralph Reed, the former Christian coalition leader and all-around, you know, religious good guy, considered a bright, young, shining star. star of the Christian right. He had been running for lieutenant governor in Georgia when all of this broke. And by all of this with Abramoff, it includes Ralph Reed working with Abramoff and funneling all sorts of Abramoff money from Indian tribes that had existing casinos into anti-gambling campaigns throughout the South that were meant to shut down the possibility of either states or other Native American tribes from operating competing gaming establishments. And of course, it was all done under the whole idea of, you know, it being immoral and anti-Christian and, you know, nothing whatsoever about all the money from these campaigns coming from the very immoral establishments that these folks were criticizing. Reed was running for lieutenant governor of Georgia, and glory be, he lost 55% to 45%. He probably would have won the walk had had the Abramoff thing not come about. And another interesting primary result on the same day in neighboring Alabama, by the way, was that George Wallace Jr. was also running for lieutenant governor, and he too lost 55% to 45%, kind of an interesting indication that the you know, the politics of segregation, at least so far as you know, as the name George Wallace means anything to Alabamans, that's what it means, that it's not enough to carry an election anymore, that the state and the population and the South in general are slowly but surely changing.
And it looks like both at a national level and then here within the state of Washington that our elected officials have been making some decisions in terms of gay marriage.
Yeah, well, let's start with national, which people probably heard less about. After the Senate a month or so ago rejected the amendment for a ban on gay marriage, Republican leaders went ahead and wanted to have a vote for it in the House anyway, because, of course, the whole purpose of bringing up this amendment isn't to try and get it to pass, although if it happened, I'm sure they would have been pleased, but it was to put Democrats running for re-election in November on the record as not a marriage so that it can be run against by their Republican opponents. And of course, as a representative, every Democrat as well as every Republican will be running for re-election in November. So they went ahead and had the vote in the House, and how about that? They lost in the House as well. And not only that, but in the House as well as in the Senate, they lost by more than they lost by the last time this vote came up. So the support for a federal constitutional amendment banning gay marriage is fading a little bit. Unfortunately, it didn't happen at the local level. The state Supreme Court came out with a ruling on Wednesday. It was a very scattered and very close and very weak 5-4 decision upholding the Defense of Marriage Act, which, you know, bans gay marriage in Washington state. It really was an appalling ruling, at least if you look at both the main majority opinion, or I should call it the plurality opinion, because only 3 of 9 justices signed it, which didn't even consider the question of discrimination. What it looked at was, you know, we want to uphold the heterosexual marriage because it helps in procreation, and this is a traditional definition, yada yada. Well, as one of the dissenters pointed out, you know, there is nothing in allowing gay people to marry that would in the least bit threaten the ability of heterosexuals to procreate. It's not as though you're going to take gay people and force them into heterosexual marriages, or they're going to be so desperate for a marriage certificate of any kind that they're going to marry against their gender orientation. It just doesn't work like that. But even more appalling was the concurring opinion that was written by Richard Sanders and Jim Johnson that just blasted the Supreme Court for even considering this, and basically said, yeah, this is discriminatory, and it should be discriminatory because gay people should have no rights. I mean, they didn't come out and say it that way, but it was basically what they meant. However, there were 6 different opinions that were written by the 9 Supreme Court justices, and they were written in such a way that it really doesn't set a precedent for a future. It was very specific to this case. So there is a good chance, I think, in future years with a different composition of the Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court, that is, that this kind of ruling can be overturned. However, that being said, the composition of the Supreme Court can change in different ways. Jim Johnson, one of the 2 people who came in and said they shouldn't be considering this at all because gay people are so appalling, was just elected 2 years ago, and he was elected from an enormous amount of, he's among other things, Tim Iman's former lawyer, and he was elected with an enormous amount of money from the BIAW, the essentially the trade association for the building industry in Washington State, which is a very powerful conservative lobby. And the BIAW is trying to do it again this year. They're trying to stack the state Supreme Court with conservative justices who will back property rights and who will back conservative social causes at the same time. And a guy named John Groen is running this year with BIAW money, trying to unseat Chief Justice Jerry Alexander, who's been on the state Supreme Court for 30 years. Now, the state had a new law which went into effect on June 7th that limits contributions that individuals can make to state Supreme Court races to only $1,400 in a primary, $1,400 in a general. It had been unlimited up until June 7th. And how about that, when the reports on contributions came out after the end of June, it turns out that just in the run-up to June 7th, the BIAW and assorted individuals who were affiliated with it donated massive amounts of money to John Groen, $10,000 at a pop, $25,000 at a pop, so that Groen raised $300,000 compared to Jerry Alexander, the 30-year incumbent's $75,000 so far. That's the kind of a war chest that he's going to have with the backing of the BIAW to put yet another conservative voice on the state Supreme Court. And the BIAW wants to do this with a couple of other positions as well. So this sort of thing needs to be publicized, and people need to be aware that we could be seeing at Washington, Washington State, an even more extreme example of what Bush has done to pack the U.S. Supreme Court, and not just Bush, but Bush Sr. and Reagan and, you know, over the last 20 years, so that we have the kind of reactionary U.S. Supreme Court that we now have. We're at real risk of getting one in Washington State as well, and one, moreover, that's really fundamentally out of step with the politics and legal views of, I think, a solid majority of Washington State voters.
Okay, running short on time, time for just one more thing. Glenn Milner, local activist, had a decision come down a week ago.
Yeah, he finally got a ruling, and we talked about this case a lot when he had his hearing last December. The Coast Guard had wanted to fine him initially $32,000, then $10,000 for allegedly getting too close to a U.S. Navy vessel during a seafair protest on Elliott Bay on 2004. And Milner had all kinds of evidence to prove that he had never done this. He contested it in a hearing before a Coast Guard officer. She said she would take it under advisement and come back with a decision. And lo and behold, 7 months later, she finally came back with a decision, which Glenn is not happy with because it did not vindicate him. They basically gave him, did not fine him, but gave him a warning and probation. However, it really does have to be considered a victory for Glenn, because that kind of a reversal and that kind of a kangaroo court, it's a Coast Guard court, almost never happens. And it's a face-saving kind of thing for the Coast Guard. You know, it's almost like a judge saying, okay, we'll just give you time served, when it's obvious that somebody's been rotting in jail for, you know, however long before they come to court, and then they never should have been charged as well. I really think that's the case with Glenn, and, you know, the support that he got from other peace activists around the community and the enormous amount of work he did, it really helped show that that he was being unfairly persecuted by the Coast Guard. But he also put an enormous amount of his time and enormous amount of his own money into the defense. So in that way, he really has been badly penalized by the Coast Guard anyway, regardless of what the hearing officer had decided.
Talking, as we do just about every week, with Jav Parrish, co-editor of Eat This State. And Jav, where do people find Eat This State?
Eat the State is put out every couple of weeks. It's a free publication that you can find at bookstores and cafes and King County Library System and anywhere else you you pick up your local Daily Shoppers. You can also find it on the web, the current as well as all the past issues, at www.eatthestate.org. And if you have questions or comments, tips, want to make any suggestions, give us a call. Our number is area code 206-719-6947.